some members are here.
And we've been lucky.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, members of the committee. Thank you very much. Legislative Fiscal Office is represented at the dais by Legislative Fiscal Officer of the State, Paul Warner. And
here we go again.
Your past has come back. Yeah, thank heavens. Legislative Revenue Officer for the State, Paul Warner, Dr. Paul Warner, and Christy Bowman is our clerk for the day. We are going today to go ahead, and we will begin by opening a work session for the possible introduction of bills. Colleagues, you have before you a LC for session introduction worksheet listing about 9 bills there and legislative concepts beginning with 833 through 1961. It's the horizontal sheet that should be in your file. The first legislative concept, 833, I would like for Representative Mark Hass to go ahead and tell us about this particular concept. Representative Hass.
Thank you, Chair Butler. What this is a simple, I won't say simple because there's extensive policy here, but it's a simple change in the formula that would move kindergarten from its current 2.5 hours a day to 5 hours a day, and it would do that through the formula. And we'll have plenty of time to spend on the overwhelming field of research and why this is a good idea. I did leave with you a lab report from Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory in Portland. It's a few years old, but it goes through some of the research about full-day kindergarten and the benefits from for children in particularly their grade school years. I would like to say there is also a companion bill to this that deals with ESDs, and it also changes the formula. To me, that's a good way to pay for the additional costs of moving to extended day kindergarten for those districts who choose to do that. This legislation doesn't require it. It gives districts the option. So that bill isn't quite drafted. It will be. They are both bills that can be accomplished by changing the formula, which is the purview of this committee, and that's what they're about.
Thank you. Colleagues, Vice Chair Berger has indicated to me that I misspoke. This is LC 923, in case you're looking for that. I beg your pardon. Stampede, we apologize.
Oh, I was hoping. I was hoping Representative Hass would speak on 833.
That's a little bit shorter.
Thank you
very much.
923.
Right. 923 is the LC that Representative Hass was speaking to. And Representative Hass and Senator Charlie Ringo have made this this particular piece of legislation an important part of some of the things that they're encouraging us.
Mr. Chair, this 833.
I'm sorry, 923.
Okay.
923. We're still continue on with that as much as Representative Hass had introduced that. So I just bring that back to your attention that's a portion of what they have been working on. So let's jump back now to 833. Paul, 833 is a bill that we see every session, as I recall, as long as I've been here anyway. Can you maybe tell us what 833 is about?
Mr. Chair, in the interim, one of the things that Dexter Johnson does to occupy himself is to go through the existing tax statutes and for legislative counsel, and what he does is find those inconsistencies, obsolete statutes, making sure that references are to the proper ORS, and this is the outcome of that. It's called the revisor's bill, and we've typically done this as a committee bill, but it's designed to have absolutely no policy impact. I mean, that's the intent, to have no policy impact, but rather to correct Oregon statutes. And so if you notice there on the relating to clause, is a very narrow relating clause, correcting erroneous material. So this is a standard piece of work for the committee to do each session.
colleagues, this is the bill that when you carry it to the floor, Representative Comp, they'll ask you if you have read it in detail and if you have presented everything fairly in your presentation. So,
yes, Chairman Butler.
I recognize that you're a person that's accustomed to the fact that says, here's your homework, there's going to be a test on it in the morning.
Okay.
So I'll have you go ahead and prepare to report back to the committee that you have read that and there'll be a test on it for us in the morning or something.
Before we go to the our field trip tomorrow or on Monday?
No, there won't be a test on it tomorrow.
It'll
be on another day.
Okay, thank you.
Continuing on with the sheet that we have for session introduction of LCs, LC 1291, and let's see, there's somebody here from COSER. Yes, John, you're here.
Chuck's here too.
Okay, perhaps we could have John and Chuck come forward, and we have we have some information. John Marshall from the OSBA, and I understand Chuck Bennett's outside from the COSER. So, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. We have for you a request for a bill introduction that would repeal the sunset or continue the two components of the state school fund distribution formula that were enacted by the 03 legislature. I think when Mr. Meyer went through his overview of school finance, hopefully you remember those two components. One was added to the small school supplement fund, was added to assist those school districts, particularly those operating small high schools and trying to create, that couldn't necessarily take advantage of economies of scale, and to try to assist those school districts in operating or trying to operate a comprehensive high school program. And the other high-cost disabilities grant was a risk pool, if you will, to assist those school districts with those extraordinarily high-cost, low-incidence students with disabilities. The school district would pay the first $25,000, and then there would be a fund available to help reimburse those excess costs. Both of those provisions are set to sunset, and what we'd like to do is create for you a vehicle to discuss those two components, look at the data, make a determination about whether they're working, how well they're working, and hopefully we can, at the end of that, make both these components a permanent part of the school fund formula. With that, Mr. Chair, I think the memo and the background is pretty well self-explanatory, but I'd be pleased to respond to any questions.
Thank you very much, John. Chuck, did you have anything that you wanted to add at this time?
No, Mr. Chairman. Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I'll just say John, but John had to say suffices.
Thank you very kindly. Questions of either Messrs. Bennett or Marshall? Yes, please. Uh-huh. Representative Comp is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. John, do you have figures about how many schools this is? I have no idea how many schools there are, 8,500 or less. So how many districts would this impact?
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, I don't have that data in front of me, but I'm certain that once you get into the discussion,
we'll get
ample data to talk about the schools that are impacted, how they use the money, and so
forth.
So more data to follow.
Thank you.
Great. Further questions? That was an excellent question. Thank you, Representative Comp. Thank you very kindly. We appreciate it. We will continue on in the consideration then. The next six legislative concepts are, these are reintroductions of interim introductions with considerably narrowed down relating clauses. And so we will go ahead and have Paul start with 1956.
Mr. Chair, I think we'd be better off to have Deborah Buchanan go through those. Deborah's originally to us from the department.
And she's wearing a lovely red blouse and sweater, and I still didn't even see her back there. Bless your heart. Sitting on the wrong side of the room from where you know it. Were you hiding on purpose?
No, Mr. Chair, just trying to keep you on your toes. my apologies. Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue, and LC 1956. This will be a rehash of the discussion we had previously in the Interim Revenue Committee. But this particular LC would allow us to refund overpayments that are claimed on a return that's filed more than 3 years after the due date of the return, but the refund would be limited to taxes paid within the prior 2 years. What we have now is a situation where taxpayers can file a return more than 3 years late, and depending on whether or not they show tax to pay on the return or ask for a refund on the return, that determines whether or not we can send them back money of payments in the prior 2 years. So it's just fixing what we think is an anomaly in the statute, an unintended provision.
Really creates an equity situation, and my colleagues, this is something that I've faced from time to time with folks that decide to come forward with their taxes, and they've had withholdings in some years and owe money in other years, and this creates an equitable situation, and I think it creates probably a little more level playing field and opportunity for folks to come even with the State Department of Revenue and file their tax returns. Thank you. Let's move on to 1957.
Mr. Chairman, LC 1957 is similar. We believe that what happened with this statute is when it was originally enacted, it applied to our ability to apportion refunds of withholding. So if a couple filed a joint return and both of them showed withholdings and they wanted that refund apportioned between the two, we're able to do that. But the statute doesn't talk about refunding estimated payments, which are a fairly recent addition to the statute. So the question for us is, we can make an apportionment of a withholding refund, but if it also includes estimated payments, are we authorized to apportion estimated payments? We also now have a refundable tax credit, and the question would be, can we apportion that if the taxpayer is asked to have it apportioned?
Thank you. Again, 1957 deals with an issue, again, that was presented in the interim. Representative Olson remembers that well. Wait a minute.
No.
It was Representative Galizio that was here, wasn't it? Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Everybody, with the exception of three of us, have not been here. So that's why I say that it's pretty important that these folks hear this as well, Deborah. I realize that it sounded like you could run the tape recorder on reverse and replay this, but because we're reintroducing these with corrected relating clauses, thank you very much. Moving on to 1958.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I'm not giving you enough information, please.
No, we'll hear them when they come out and go for them.
LC 1958 relates to the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit, which, as you've heard, was introduced in 1999, I believe, and became refundable in 2003. And one of the things that we have identified that we think you may want to reconsider is, in determining this credit, the taxpayer has to look at the amount of adjusted gross income that they have, and then also their earned income. And there are requirements that they have a certain level of earned income and that their adjusted gross income be less than a certain amount. The way the statute is drafted, the taxpayer looks at federal adjusted gross income. So what has happened is we have, in some cases, non-resident taxpayers who have income that meets the requirements, and they are able to claim the credit, but their earned income, for example, is not from Oregon. So they may not be working in Oregon at all. They may have rental income or other types of passive income from Oregon. They're able to claim the credit because their federal numbers work, but if they were Oregon residents, they wouldn't qualify. So this particular legislative concept would change those to Oregon numbers so that they need to look at their Oregon adjusted gross income and their Oregon earned income to see whether or not they would be able to take the credit.
Thank you. Deborah, questions? We'll move on, please, to 1959.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 1959 has to do with filing returns for pass-through entities. These are things like partnerships or S-corporations. Under current law, the Department of Revenue has the authority to adopt rules that allow pass-through entities to file a single return on behalf of non-resident members. So you may have a large partnership with 20 non-resident partners. That partnership can file one return with Oregon, report all of the non-resident partners, and pay the tax on behalf
of those non-resident partners. It works well for us as an administrative agency, and it works well for the partners because they don't have to then each file an individual return to report a single item of income, but the state is still getting the tax that's owed to it. So that's in law now. So you might ask, well, why do we need this concept? Well, this one is adopting a uniformity recommendation that the Multi-State Tax Commission put forward. So it adopts that uniform language, but a new provision in this would also allow for withholding of tax for those pass-through items, so that if a non-resident partner did not join in this entity filing, the partnership would withhold income tax and remit that to the department, and then they would claim that as withholding when they file their individual return. So an effort to help with the compliance for those non-resident members to make sure that some filing is being done.
Assists with the paperwork in your department as well then as the compliance of those non-resident partners of an Oregon resident tax return partnership.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions, clarification? Move to 1960, please, if you would, Deborah.
All right. Mr. Chair, LC 1960 is sort of a matching up provision between individual tax returns and entity tax returns. The situation that we have now is that if I, as an individual, file my tax return on time, but I don't report an item of income from a partnership that I have, and the three-year statute of limitations runs, then the partnership files a return and shows that income item. The department can't come back and adjust my return because the statute of limitations has run. So what you have is a situation where an individual can file, not report an item, and later a pass-through files and reports the item, and there's no adjustment allowed. What this would do is match up those two things to say that if I fail to report an item of income on my return, and 4 years later this partnership reports that when they file the return, the department could come back and adjust my return just for that item, only that item, and nothing else on the return. So kind of matching those two things.
And we'll also discuss then what happens when the pass-through entity files an amended return at the three-year mark relative to the item as well, I assume, Deborah, is that
we
correct?
We could do that. Yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
For the questions relative to 1960, as we move on to 1961.
Mr. Chairman, LC 1961 has to do also with pass-through entities, but it's dealing with people who are part-year residents of Oregon. We have situations where individuals move in to the state or out of the state during the year, and if they have income from a partnership or an S corporation, this would prescribe how they report that income on the Oregon return. This is reflecting a court case that was decided just a few years ago in the Magistrate Division of the Oregon Tax Court, and it said for an S corporation, use a per share per day allocation. This is dealing not only with S corporations but with partnerships, and the basic underlying theory is you look at how many days you were a resident of Oregon during the year, and for that period of time you take all of the income attributable to the flow through. For the time that you were a non-resident, you look at only Oregon source income. So it's just a splitting up of the income from that pass-through entity.
And does it, at this point, I haven't read it, the LC, and I don't recall the discussion. Does it then preclude specific identification at that point, Deborah?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it does preclude that, but I would like to read it again
okay,
to answer that.
Much.
Definitely.
That will be a question that we'll need to address. Thank you very much. There were other questions of Ms. Buchanan while she's here? Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. Colleagues, I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of considering legislative concepts 833 through 1961 to be introduced before the as committee introduced bills, and as to legislative my specific motion is as follows: as to legislative concept 833, that it be introduced as a House committee House Revenue Committee bill, with regard to LC 923, that it be introduced as a House committee bill, that with regard to LC 1291, that it be introduced by the committee on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the Oregon School Boards Association. With regards to LC 1956, 1957, 1958, 1959, 1960, and 1961, that those bills be introduced to the House Revenue Committee on behalf of the Department of Revenue. Is there any discussion as to the motion which I've made? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, we will so order. Thank you very much. We will close the work session dealing with the introduction of legislative concepts for session introduction on behalf of the House Revenue Committee. Colleagues, I will now open a House Revenue Committee public hearing on House Bill 2030. Maz, would you like to tell us what we're doing here today?
Mr. Chair, in addition to giving me smoking, drinking, and gambling, they gave me the credit cards, too. So we'll be talking about debt today. The bills that you will have today in House Bill 2030 is a bill introduced by the Oregon State Treasurer. And what it basically tries to do is work with the programs for electronic fund transfers and store credit cards, if you will, in order to allow state agencies to use these instruments for payments and stop producing paper checks, if you will. Because of the nature of the bill, I have consulted with the fiscal office, and at this time they anticipate that there will be a positive fiscal. However, the amounts and the discussion of how much have not been established yet because of contacts with different agencies still going on in order to establish these amounts. But
do you have a timeline on that?
Probably we're looking at by next week this time.
Excellent, Chair.
But for an example, that this procedure has been piloted by the Department of Employment or the Employment Department, and if they go all the way with all the checks and processes, they're talking about $2 million savings. However, there is no new revenue, so no revenue impact in that sense. And also we have the representatives of the State Treasurer here.
Thank you very much, Maz. Any questions for Maz before we bring forward Jan Coleman and Darren Bond? And let's see. We both have written testimony. And Jan has information with an amendment, and you are from OACC Yamhill County. Jen?
I am, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a new procedure for me. I'm a very new county clerk from Yamhill County, so please prompt me if I'm doing something wrong here. Today I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks.
Jan, would you just state your name also for the record as well?
My name is Jan Coleman. I am the Yamhill County Clerk.
Thank you.
As I said, I am here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Having read the bill and so forth, a few of the clerks have a concern. Our concern, as we basically, we would like to support with an amendment. We appreciate the fiscal savings here and so forth, but we do have counties that with financial systems that it would be difficult for them to trace the electronic transfer of funds. We already, most of us receive IRS payments in that manner, but there are some counties who have not been able to implement that because of their financial assistance and so forth. We receive a number of county or state payments because we record all kinds of liens from state agencies, and we record deed and mortgage records from state agencies. So we bill a number of state agencies monthly, and we would have payments coming from these state agencies into our systems. It's a matter of tracking for most of us. Right now, in my county, the way we track the IRS is we have to take them, the treasurer, a copy of our billing, and when it comes into the bank account, she traces that back to it. There is no documentation to tell us what those payments are coming. And I know this bill provides for some program to be set up, and we respect that that could be done, you know, in the procedure. But we also think that there's a few, and these are mostly smaller counties, who probably have older financial systems and so forth, and this would be a difficulty for. So there are some there's that we would like to request that you add a statement after one, Section 1B that would say no state agency may assess a penalty to any entity that is unable to receive any of the payments by electronic fund transfer.
Thank you, Jan. Why don't we do this? Why don't we just go ahead and have Darren from the Oregon State Treasurer's Office, Darren Bond, present the Treasurer's position. And then, Darren, I would like your response to the concerns that the treasurers and clerks have presented here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. The purpose of House Bill 2030 is to reduce the number of checks produced by state agencies. In fiscal year 2004, state agencies produced nearly 9 million checks. Over that same period of time, they produced about 3.2 million electronic payments into payee bank accounts. Our goal is to switch those numbers around. Electronic payments, primarily automated clearinghouse payments, are much more efficient and cost-effective for agencies to produce and manage. The Department of Human Services has calculated that it costs them about 64 cents in hard cost to produce a check. It costs 7 cents for an ACH transaction. Administrative costs associated with checks usually dwarf the hard costs. With ACH payments, there are no internal control issues around check stock, around check signers, or redeemed checks. There are no lost checks, stolen checks, or check fraud. House Bill 2030 allows agencies to, by rule, establish programs that rely on electronic funds transfer as the primary payment mechanism. At the same time, House Bill 2030 prohibits an agency from requiring that a payee open a bank account as a condition of payment. Instead, an agency could enroll the payee in a program using an electronic payment device known as an electronic payment card or a stored value card. For the stored value card, payees who don't have a bank account or choose not to have their funds deposited to a bank account would receive a Visa-branded payment card. This card would allow free access to funds through a limited number of bank teller transactions or ATM transactions and unlimited point-of-sale transactions at grocery stores, gas stations, etc. Benefits to the payee include no check cashing fees, no need to carry large amounts of cash, access to funds that literally, and in the written testimony I said thousands, it's actually millions of merchants and banks worldwide. There's 74,000 Visa merchants in Oregon alone. And there are statements available over the internet and by mail. The benefit to the agency is that the payments are made via ACH once the stored value card is issued. And as Mazin indicated, the Employment Department estimates that they'd enjoy annual savings ranging from $2 million to $2.5 million, depending on the number of persons receiving benefits at any given time. Relative to the county's concerns, we wouldn't have a problem with some type of amendment like that. We never contemplated, honestly, payments to counties. It's not a big volume of payments from the state. We're looking at things like employment, like child support enforcement, payroll, where there are large numbers of payees where the economies of scale would dictate that significant savings for the state could be realized. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boquist, recognized.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Would you address our tax refunds? one of those things we're going to do electronically only versus issuing check?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boakwis, again, this would be done by rule. Normally, a tax return wouldn't be applicable to this kind of environment, where the cost benefit is normally realized in a recurring payment scenario, where we're seeing a weekly or monthly payment as opposed to a one-time payment. So issuance of a car usually wouldn't be cost effective in that kind of a scenario. And the actual cost benefit of that would ultimately be determined by the Department of Revenue.
Madam Chair, follow-up question?
By all means.
But what you're saying is, regardless of the termination normally, if we pass this, they could in fact use an administrative rule and issue tax refunds by electronic means, correct? As written.
Madam Chair, Representative Boakwis, yes, I believe so.
Further questions? Waiting.
I have one briefly for our clerk. Do you have any idea how many counties are in this particular
situation?
Yeah.
By in, I would say, you know, roughly half a dozen. It's not very many.
Thank you. There being no further questions, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Vice Chair. Colleagues, we'll go ahead then and close the public hearing on House Bill 2030. And we'll now go ahead on to 2031. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2031.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2031 also comes to us from the Oregon State Treasurer. And this bill is primarily trying to catch up with the technology of the times, if you will, with the new standards of Check 21 and so on, which allows for checks to be considered as an electronic copy or electronic image, rather than having the check physically delivered to the clearinghouse. This also allows the state treasurer to use the same practices accordingly. With that, there was no revenue impact or net fiscal impact statement.
Thank you very much, Matt. We're going to go ahead and invite Darren Bond to come forward from the Oregon State Treasurer's Office. Darren, you want to sign in, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. House Bill 2031 is a housekeeping bill that cleans up current statutory language to reflect modern banking practices relative to the presentment of checks and warrants. Current language refers to surrender and delivery, which is outdated because it contemplates paper transactions. Because payments today are based on presentment of electronic cash letters and electronic files of paid items, the appropriate term is presentment. Treasury uses electronic information to pay the bank and charge the appropriate state agencies for that day's presentments. Again, these changes reflect current practice. No additional efforts are imposed, or no additional requirements are imposed on any state agencies.
Thank you, Darren. Questions by members of the committee for Mr. Bond? Darren, I'd like to see you at my office, if I could, at some point regarding all three of these bills. Relative to just some concerns that I have of how this will affect small businesses and people in rural Oregon. We're talking about lots of electronic issues, and I still have a few small institutions that are doing hand posting in some of my district in rural Oregon. And so with regard to the fact that we talk about the ease of using a credit card and those kinds of things, I may not have a store that would accept a credit card in some small communities out there. So I'm just anxious about those kinds of things, dealing with electronic and how it would affect the smallest of some of our districts. I don't want to impede progress, but I would like your expression privately on that.
Mr. Chair, your convenience.
Thank you. Further questions? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much, Jaron. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2031. Colleagues, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2032. Lance, would you like to bring us up to date, please?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2032 has to deal primarily with the ways that the state treasurer works with the bonding requirements that it helps the state agencies in acquiring, and basically trying to clarify and give some flexibility in the ways of where it requires cash flow forecasts or cash flow predictions, if you will, and for what purpose, and when is it sufficient and when it's not, and when is it allowable for the treasurer to determine that these are not necessarily needed for some debt instruments such as COP, certificate of participations, and so on. So it tries to inject that flexibility with the state treasurer. And we have the debt manager for the state treasurer here to talk about it, and I've checked with the fiscal officer, he had no fiscal impact per se, and we have also no revenue impact on it.
Thank you, Mass. We welcome Laura Lachlan McCall, and Laura, we're going to be hearing from you, I think, probably soon again, aren't we? You're going to come and tell us about something else that you do in the state, surely. Please go ahead and sign in for the record, and then let us know the Treasurer's position with regard to 2032.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of Debt Management in the Oregon State Treasurer's Office. Briefly, I'm fairly new to the state. I've been here for 4 months, and so I inherited this bill that had been prepared. But in a nutshell, the state treasurer's office has a responsibility to oversee all the debt issuance within the state, to make sure that all the various state agencies have good cash flows to cover the debt service costs for their various types of bonds. And the state law reflects that. However, over the years, there's been a variety of new types of debt instruments, in particular certificates of participation, that are really appropriation credits. There really isn't a mortgage revenue cash flow or a transportation tax cash flow to cover the bond indebtedness. The law just clarifies that in those instances, the state treasurer has the discretion to waive the requirement to do a cash flow analysis, since really it's a general fund appropriation credit. We will continue to do detailed cash flow analysis for all the bond issues where there are revenue flows. But this law just brings our current practice more in line in state law, bringing them together in a practical fashion.
Thank you, Laura. Are there further questions for Laura relative to House Bill 2032, authorizing the Treasurer to exempt state agencies from cash flow projection or reporting requirements for issuance of general obligation revenue bonds on making certain findings? Thank you very much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2032. Colleagues, that brings us to the end of today's agenda. I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm drinking out of a fire hose. Most of this kinds of stuff is certainly information that I'm familiar with from my business background, from prior legislative sessions, and I recognize that five of the members here do not have any information about prior legislative sessions, having sat at the dais before on these kinds of issues. So I, before we bring back up 2030, 2031, and 2032, I would encourage you to invite those folks who you've seen here today to please offer testimony, including the Clerks Association and others, to you in your offices. Make arrangements to meet them at a time convenient to both of you. And the names of the folks, and I hope that the telephone numbers of Laura Lockwood McCall as well as Jan Coleman. And, well, Jan has left her phone number here, from but you can also reach your county clerk or clerks, and would encourage you to do that. That these are issues that they feel strongly enough about to have their representative come here today on behalf of themselves from your district, and I would encourage you to follow up on those issues. So with that, just let's, for the next time we get back together, again, I feel like that I'm just in the dust, and I'm so grateful to have two vice chairs that have been here before who just know that this is just standard fare, that it just starts coming like this. But we'll start doing the hard stuff in just a few weeks. We're just going to kind of work into it. So with that that admonition, I'm going to go ahead and close today's public hearing and this session. But I do want to remind us all that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission would love to see us tomorrow at 2:00. Again, I apologize for having made a previous date with constituency issues tomorrow at 4:00 completely out of the capital area. So I will not be able to attend. But with that, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'm intending to go there and am offering place in my card anybody who wants to contact me.
Wonderful. Representative Berger will go, and Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I can't make it. I wish I could, but I have a meeting in the district tomorrow. House business, and I will be there. So.
Excellent. Other members that would like to make an expression, again, I know that a number of you already have told me that you've got a number of issues, and on behalf of the committee, I wish to express our sympathy to Representative Boquist and the loss of a family member. And Representative Boquist, may God be with you as you go about your activities. I apologize for not recognizing that earlier. Thank you very much. With that, members, colleagues, we'll go ahead and stand adjourned until we come back in on Prayer Official on Monday at 1:30.